After the buzzer, checking in on the day after Halloween. I'm Mike Gross, and my partner, Gordy Jones, is alongside. Gordy, how the heck are you?
Outstanding, sir.
All right, that's good.
I can't believe it's November.
But it is, and it feels like November outside.
It does.
I had to hike to the office from the parking garage today. And that was cold. That was cold. I was freezing, man.
Yeah, man. Yeah. It went from 80 degrees a couple days ago to here we are.
But supposedly it's coming back in a couple days. Back up to 65, 70, whatever.
Well, we do weather. We'll do traffic next.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And your calls. No, not your calls. I would love that, but we can't do that.
Actually,
we're not set up to do that in any way, shape, or form.
I'm still struggling with just doing this.
Yeah, just make the stinking equipment work is enough of a challenge for us. But anyway, the thing we're going to talk about today is we were going to have a Sixers writer on, but they're so overwhelmed, apparently, yes. with work, thanks to the fact that they don't have James Harden to kick around anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, Gordy, your immediate reaction to the trade that sent Harden to the Clippers for stuff.
Right. So here's the entire rundown.
Yeah.
The Sixers sent James Harden, PJ Tucker, Philip Petrusev to the Clippers. And the Sixers acquire Nicholas Batum, Robert Covington, Kenyon Martin Jr., Marcus Morris Sr., an unprotected 2028 first rounder, a 2026 first rounder, which is actually with OKC right now. It's the least favorable of OKC, the Clippers, and Houston. A 2029 pick swap, and two number twos. The consensus seems to be that the Sixers did pretty well, but really that will be determined by what Daryl Morey can do from this point forward. If he can turn those assets, the four players they acquired, their appeal is largely the fact that they're all in the last years of their contract. And three of them are over 30. That would be Batum, Covington, and Morris. Kenyon Martin Jr., he's 22, and he might have some promise and some long-term usefulness, but he, too, is in the last year of a contract. So I guess it's a matter of what they can do from this point forward, because as it stands, they acquired cap flexibility. Okay. But I think they're more in the win-now mode, especially in regard to Joel Embiid, keeping him happy and wanting to stay in Philadelphia long-term. I think that's what happens from here on is what I'm really curious about.
Yeah, and they are going to make a deal, and they'll probably make one at this trade deadline and during the season, right? I guess.
The mid-season deadline.
And obviously this is, as you described, Gordy, these are pieces that can be add-ins to a trade. You know, that's what they're shooting for. And maybe, you know, when we get a month from now, 6 weeks from now, when teams start to figure out what they are and aren't,
yeah,
you know, then maybe a player that could be a difference maker could be available. But here's one thing I thought about this is the Sixers played three games.
Mm-hmm.
They're 2-1, and the loss was by one on the road at Milwaukee, which might be the best team in the league or one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder how much they looked at their team and looked at the way Maxey played and Embiid is Embiid and thought, well, we can play with this if we have to, at least for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how much those three games played into, okay, let's pull the trigger.
I think probably to some degree, because particularly the way Tyrese Maxey has played out of the gate, he's averaging 30 points a game over the first three games. He was the Eastern Conference Player of the Week for the season's first week. I was there on Sunday, and before the game, I asked Chauncey Billups about Maxey, and he described him as the straw that stirs the drink for the Sixers, I thought was a pretty strong statement considering they have the MVP on their team. But he didn't really back off that. He said he's the guy. He's the one that makes them go. And I think there's some truth in that.
I think it's like effective field goal percentage. It's like 69% for him.
Yeah.
And something like 19 assists and 3 turnovers so far.
That's pretty good.
He's one of those guys who at times looks like a loose cannon because he goes so fast and he's capable of going so fast. But there really is a lot of control to his game. He doesn't make a ton of mistakes, and he can really shoot. He has become a really good shooter, which he really wasn't right out of college.
No.
But he is now.
Yeah, I mean, this year he's shooting 56% from 3-for-3. Now, that's probably not sustainable. But the last 2 years, he shot over 40.
Yeah.
And
That is sustainable, apparently.
Yeah.
And he seems like a guy who really works at it. Yes. You know, I can get to the next level if I do this, so I'm going to work on this. He's money.
By all accounts, he's a hard worker and a really good guy.
Yeah.
And relishes being a good guy. In fact, I talked to him after the game about that. Have you ever been in a bad mood? And he said, I would never let anybody know that.
Wow.
He said, I would never let anybody. But he said his goal every day is to come in the gym and first get Joel Embiid started, get him in a good mood, and then go from there. Which I think is a pretty admirable way to look at things.
I really like that.
Yeah,
that's
so
good.
I think what you see, I mean, with a lot of guys, what you see is not necessarily what you get, but I think what you see in his case is what you get. I think he really is a good guy, a hard worker, and a guy, I think he's going to be an all-star this year. I think what he's doing now, maybe not to this degree, is sustainable.
Yeah,
30
right.
game, but I mean, I think over 20 is certainly sustainable. I think he can be an all-star this year.
Now, what about Embiid has been Embiid,
yep.
which is a good thing, obviously.
Yeah.
How about the rest of the group? What do you think of...
Well, that's in fact one of the things I wanted to talk about. Of the guys they acquired, who do they plug in now to that slot that P.J. Tucker was playing? Because P.J. he's reached the point in his career where he's not even making open threes.
Yeah.
And if he's not doing that, then you have a real question mark on your hands. So it could be Covington. It could be Batum. It could be Kelly Oubre, who's played well to date. But one of the other things that really impressed me about the Sixers on Sunday, and granted, Portland is a terrible team. They beat them by like 30. But the way the Sixers play now, there's a lot of ball and player movement. It's very noticeable how there's a lot more energy on that end of the floor.
I agree. And the thing that we haven't mentioned yet is Nick Nurse, who I think is the reason for what you just described. And also, he'll get the most that can be gotten out of them defensively, I think.
Seems so.
Yeah. So that's... he's a big advocate of that... even if we're going to give up a three once in a while, keep the guy in front of you, protect the paint, protect the rim, and you could obviously Embiid would be a really good weapon in that sense.
Yeah.
Kind of the Spurs long-time approach to defense, he's on that tree. But so, I mean, maybe if you're the Sixers ownership management, you're looking at this and saying, we could maybe be a 4 seed in the East with this, and maybe we can hit the jackpot with a big move and move up a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's how they have to look at it. I while they do have a lot of cap flexibility next summer, I think they're definitely, as I said before, I think they're definitely in like, let's see what we can do in season, because there's going to be some teams that are going to be looking to offload guys. I wrote down some names just off the top of my head. Pascal Siakam, DeMar DeRozan, Zach LaVine, Buddy Hield, OG Anunoby. And of those, Anunoby is the one that has the most appeal to me just because he can guard and he can shoot. Now, whether you can pry him away from Toronto is another question, because his name has been out there as a possible trade candidate for a while now.
How old is he? Like, what point in his career?
I'm going to have to look that up there, Mike.
You know, I think Buddy Hield is too much of a specialist to really make a big hit with. I like Siakam, but I'm not sure how he plays with Embiid.
Yeah.
Does that work?
I
don't know. So process of elimination of those guys. And LaVine, same thing with, well, I don't know. LaVine is very athletic.
I don't know. He needs the ball, though. And if you know, every shot he takes is a shot you take away from Maxi. Do you want that? And he can't guard either. So then you have two really poor defensive players. OG is 26. And
that's good.
Yeah, for his career, he averages 11.5, shoots 47 from the field, 37 from three, so that's acceptable. So,
he's good defensively.
Yeah, he's like a 6'7", you know, wiry defensive guy. So,
okay.
To me, that would be the best fit.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not the sexiest name. I've always been fascinated.
That's the thing. It's not a sexy name. It's
no.
Not, it's not one that's going to be a headline thing.
But I think he's a winning player.
But
those are the kind of guys
don't
you
worry
win
about
with.
That.
The guy who fascinates me, and I'm not sure he's a great fit either, is, I mentioned before, DeMar DeRozan. A guy who you know what he's going to do, and he goes and does it anyway. Yeah. Guys like that always fascinate
me. Bob Dandridge.
Yeah. He's going to get his shot. He's gonna nail 7 elbow jumpers every night. And you know what he's going to do, and he still does it.
It would be cool to have a guy like that kind of on your second unit,
yeah.
You know, but you're not going to go make this big splash and get a guy that doesn't start.
Right, right.
That brings me a little bit to Kelly Oubre, who mm-hmm. he's very athletic.
Yeah,
he's a guy who is going to put up numbers on a bad team.
Yeah,
but is he going to be? Could he be like Vinny Microwave Johnson coming off the bench for the Sixers a little bit?
I mean, he's played well in that role. I mean, he's a wiry guy. He shot it better than I expect. He's like a 33% career.
Yeah, and again, that might be sample size.
But, I mean, who knows? I mean, he's done pretty well to date. So, it's interesting to me. Their team interests me. Here's another thing that interests me. What the hell are the Clippers going to do with Harden, Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, and Russell Westbrook?
Is that the worst mix of talent in NBA history?
It's got to be close.
I mean, if you're, who are the most ball-dominant players in NBA history? Well, Harden and Westbrook are in the top 5 in the history of the game.
Yes.
And you've got to give Kawhi Leonard his touches. Yep. And then, like Paul George is the number 4 guy. I mean, it's a stockpile of talent,
right?
But it's aging talent, often injured talent. Mm-hmm.
Correct.
And 4 guys. There's only 1 basketball.
I know. I don't know how their mix works. I mean, to me, neither of these teams improve themselves to championship level.
No,
at least not at this point.
My God,
the Clippers have a bunch of other bodies too. I mean, what do you do with Tucker? Does he play at all?
Yeah.
And they have that Zubats guy whose first name I can never pronounce, but he's a pretty good player.
Now, is Tucker's deal expiring?
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
So that was actually one of the good things the Sixers did. He makes $11 million a year, which for what he's given you, I don't think that's a worthwhile
investment. And they thought he was going to be a real difference maker just in terms of attitude and defense when they got him, right?
Yeah.
And now I think he's a little past the point where that is really a...
He doesn't help you, really.
Where you can be the final piece.
Yeah, I mean, a couple years ago, he was really good defensively, particularly against Giannis, but now... I think he's kind of, if not on the downside, you know, done.
I mean, the Clippers are. But, I mean, maybe they don't care. Maybe they look at the West and say, we got no shot. Let's have some big names and put some people in the arena with that boy.
They're building a new arena.
So that's part of it. Too, but
so there's commerce involved here, too, as far as the Clippers are concerned.
They're in this weird spot where they're always second fiddle to the Lakers, of course, and if you throw in they're like maybe number 4 or 5 in LA, I mean, they're not even close. But they have an owner who has a gazillion dollars, and they're, as I understand it, they're light years over the luxury tax.
Yeah,
and they don't seem to care.
I mean, of those guys, I mean, Harden was actually kind of the ball distributor for the Sixers last year and was pretty good at it. He was like a borderline all-star.
Especially when he really committed to it.
Yeah.
Sometimes he didn't, but, you know.
But he had a pretty good year, led the league in assists. I mean, again, he flamed out in the playoffs. Now, you know, you would think the Clippers can at least cover for that to some degree if it happens again. You know, another thing that fascinated me about this trade, for weeks on end, the Clippers said, we're not going to get rid of Terrence Mann. And I'm like, who's Terrence Mann? And why is this the sticking point in this trade?
So, I can't help you with that one.
Yeah. I mean,
I got nothing.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it here in a minute. I've got nothing.
So
the Terrence Mann experience.
So anyway, I think that they're really at least as curious as the Sixers are to me just about how this is going to play out. But I'm really going to curious to see how the other shoe drops.
Well, I think the media consensus at least that I've seen, is that the Sixers did better than the Clippers did, and what the hell are the Clippers doing? I mean, that's sort of
they have too many bodies too. They have a bunch of guys on their bench. They still have Norman Powell, who's a pretty good player,
also a fairly ball dominant player,
yes,
though, right?
Yeah, so there's
the fifth guy. Who, I mean, what is he if he can't have the ball and go a little bit?
Yeah.
What is he? I mean,
to me, that would be a guy that I'm a little surprised he wasn't involved in this deal.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, because why do they even need him? I mean, unless they were going to flip him.
And I've seen him really light it up at times. He can score. He's a pretty... But what sense does he make with that group? I don't know.
I mean, which is an interesting thing about basketball, particularly at the pro level. You can have too many guys.
You can. Yeah.
And I think they have too many guys who can play and will make their thoughts known.
God, yeah. And, you know, the endlessly interesting thing, as you alluded there, about basketball is how are guys going to fit together? I mean, there's a 2% chance that this will work in the way that sometimes things that don't make any sense work, but even if it works, I mean, they're not challenging Denver.
No, that's the problem.
They're Denver. Not challenging Denver, and the West is so deep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just looking down their roster at some of the other guys they have on the team. Yeah, it's Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, Bones Highland, Norman Powell, Russell Westbrook, Ivica Zubats, Mason Plumlee. You got to have a Plumlee on your team.
Plumlee, it goes without saying.
Yeah. So, yeah, good luck with all that.
Wow.
I mean, it is the West, the way it's unfolded. I mean, Denver has gotten out nicely, as you would expect they would. I mean, I think they're a little short on their bench. They could probably use another guy. But, you know, they're still Denver. Dallas has started well, which is surprising to me given, you know, Luka and... Yeah. Kyrie on the same team.
And how much is Kyrie even playing? I watched him play a little bit, and Kyrie was not on the floor.
So he must have one of his
Having one of his spells.
He's having his spells. He's beklempt. And the Warriors have gotten off well, and they're using Chris Paul off the bench, which I think is the right thing to do.
I watched them play the other night against New Orleans, and it was at New Orleans. And Steph was so good. I mean, it was just amazing. It was pretty funny because it was a 2-point game at half, and the Warriors just came out and destroyed him in the second half. They ended up winning by 25 or something like that. And Steph, it's near the end of Steph's time in the game. You know, like early fourth quarter, and he makes this insane move and throws it up off the glass and it goes in. The Pelicans come down, take a quick shot and miss. He gets the ball back. Pulls up from 30, kaboom, and these two people who are like front row, sitting in the front row, a couple, a man and woman, apparently a couple, and so they're apparently like longtime season ticket holders or whatever. When that three gets it, they both like stood up and put their hands up and went, and then walked out. They left. I've had enough. They did the wave. They did the hands up, like, what the hell?
But dismissive wave.
Waved their hands, like, I've had enough. Boom, they're out of here.
The dismissive Jim Boeheim type wave.
That was really funny.
That's pretty hilarious. Yeah, well, Steph has been known to do that to people.
Yeah, he was spectacular. And Draymond did a pretty good job on Zion. Mm. I mean, Zion had 20-something, but he didn't go nuts.
Right.
And also... Chris Paul kind of running that second unit.
It's pretty brilliant.
That might work. That might work. I mean, I don't know.
I saw a quote from Steve Kerr where he compared how they're using Chris Paul to how they used Iguodala for all those years.
It's
like, here's a guy who's proven. I mean, we know he's one of our five best guys, but this is how it works best for us. And, you know, the other thing is it'll extend his career. You know, there's less wear and tear on him.
That's a good point,
Maybe it'll forestall the possibility of his annual playoff injury, which is kind of freakish how often he's been hurt in the playoffs.
That's true.
I mean, to me, they look like a very dangerous
team. Yeah, they could. And this is a relatively minor piece, but Gary Payton is
very
back.
Good player.
And he really helped them. And
I like him a lot.
The other night when I was watching him, he looked like he fits right in, you know. So they might be.
And Kuminga's giving him a little more, and Moses.
I think he was hurt. I don't think he played in that game, but or whatever reason he was out. But yeah,
they have like 10 guys they can depend on, and I think it just makes more sense to have Paul coming off the bench. It's very interesting to me. I mean, you know, Paul is not one to hide his feelings, so I'm sure they had to vet him about it. You know?
Oh yeah,
and as you should. I mean, this guy's a Hall of Fame player, and you can't just say you're coming off the bench.
And this is one of those things where maybe Curry got in there and talked, you know, and I talked to me and had some role, because supposedly he's done that a lot over the years, and that's another reason why he's valuable. But you know, and then I think the Lakers are pretty good too.
They got a lot of guys.
Yeah, the Lakers are tough. So that West is. Phoenix, I don't know.
They don't have a point guard.
I'm dubious about Phoenix.
Yes, and Beal and Bradley Booker are both hurt right now, which is...
Yeah, they're without both of them right now. I said
Bradley Devin Grant. Booker. What am I talking
about?
Yeah,
Devin, I knew you meant. The audience, the vast listening audience.
The vast listening audience.
And Durant, I think for the first time, maybe looks a little bit like age is becoming a factor. A little bit.
Yeah.
He's still great, but maybe a little bit. So I don't know if that's going to work. And that's another, owner with gazillions who kind of wants to let everybody know he's there kind of thing.
Matt Ishbia.
Yeah.
And he's new. And that was when as soon as he got there, he said, let's trade for Kevin Durant. And they gave up probably too much.
Yeah.
You know, they gave up Mikal Bridges and Cam Johnson and a bunch of draft capital.
Yeah, and again, how does this fit together? Although, Durant and Booker on the same team. Booker is a great player. He's a top 10 player.
Speaking
in the league,
of guys who can get any shot they want, they want, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's really admirable, guys like that. Like, I'm sure we've both played in pickup games where somebody showed up who played somewhere, and just the economy of motion of guys who are really good and really know how to play is just amazing. It's endlessly fascinating to me how they can get wherever they want to go. They know how they can do it, and you can't do a thing about it.
he has become an incredible offensive player and an okay defensive player. I don't think he's a guy that everybody attacks on the other end.
But, I mean, Beal hasn't played yet, so I wonder how that's going to, work itself out.
Yeah, that's another way. Again, stockpiling scorers. I mean, you can't have too many guys. I don't know.
Yeah, but not to have a point guard, though. I mean, it seems like one guy just who needs 10 shots a game and can get these guys 25 each. You know,
they don't have that.
No, they don't have that.
They don't have even close to that. Although Booker is a very skilled player, he's not that. No,
I guess he's kind of like what passes for one now. So also Boston has gotten off well, and Milwaukee has won two of their first three. I mean, and...
Both those teams look great.
They would be the top two teams in the East, I would think, just by process of elimination. And the Sixers are in that next group, you know, depending on what happens from here on as far as how they sort out the roster. But we know Daryl Morey will be working the phones, that he's a guy that is going to be aggressive as far as fleshing this out and hoping it makes sense. But, I mean, just to get out from under the whole Harden thing.
We don't have to think about it anymore.
Because in the second half the other night, you know, Harden was actually sitting on the bench, and I said to Jack McCaffrey, the guy from the Delaware County Dealers, I just said, they cannot let Harden play with this group. They cannot. It cannot happen, because it'll just mess everything up. Because they do seem to have a real good flow and a good understanding of each other and an understanding of how they want to play. And he just cannot be.
And I'm sure Nick Nurse was thinking what you were thinking.
Yeah, I mean, right? And I'm sure they were pretty far along with it by then. So it's like, there's no way he could take the floor. I mean, with that group, it just couldn't happen. And I think everybody was aware, and so this is...
And there was no other team involved, apparently.
Apparently not. Yeah, it was always the Clippers all the way. That's where he wanted to go, and that was the only team that seemed like had any even a little interest in him, which is...
So I guess depending on how James Harden looks at life and looks at his career, which I don't have any insight into, he maybe, you could argue, won the trade.
Yeah,
because he wanted to go there, and he got to go there, but you know, in certainly the team that he's on now, I don't think anybody thinks won the trade.
Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of a, you know, if there's a record for you know, forcing your way off a team. He certainly has had, he holds it.
He's the career leader in that category.
He forced his way out of Houston. He forced his way out of Brooklyn. He's forced his way out of Philly. So, I mean, next year is going to, I think it is his fourth team in 22 months. I think that's what I heard on a podcast yesterday. That's amazing to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the only one that might be in the ballpark is Durant. Well, Durant didn't really force his way out of OKC. He just didn't re-sign. Then he went to Golden State. And then, you know, he forced his way out of Golden State, which is like, who does that? Who does that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good illustration of the... I mean, I don't want to kill Kevin Durant. I don't think he's a bad person or anything, but... the ego of these guys.
I know. I
mean, right?
Yeah.
I won a championship. Now I got to win one where I'm the guy, the total absolute guy. Even though I thought he sort of was the guy on that
team. I thought so too. I mean, he won the finals MVP 2 years, and it was certainly well deserved.
And like Draymond and Steph, they seemed like they totally, not, they didn't defer to him. That's not the right way to say it, but they totally were accepting of, we need this guy. He's awesome, you know. And that might be one of the best teams in NBA history. That team won it with them. It's pretty damn good.
Yeah. Pretty damn good. They're like 17 and 18, those two teams. They were awfully good.
Yeah.
I mean, they were really versatile. They could play any way they wanted to play. If they wanted to run an ISO play for Durant, they could do that. They want to run pick and roll with whomever, they could do that. And, you know, and then you got the whole Steph Clay business.
The basketball IQ is pretty high.
But, I mean, again, and we've talked about this 100 times, it's one of the many reasons to love Steph Curry, because how many people in his situation would be, you know, how many superstars would be unthreatened by a guy of Durant's stature coming to town? Like, you know, how many guys would have their agent on the phone to management saying, well, how's this going to work? Yeah. What are we doing here?
And we should point out that Steph is making a gazillion dollars, and he's had an incredibly blessed career to have been in that situation. But you're right. That doesn't matter to a lot of guys.
It's all about, you know, my brand or my touches or whatever, my endorsements, however you want to look at it.
So that
all comes into it. I would be really fascinated to see just like the day in the life of a GM, like how many times he has to field calls from agents, you know, working behind the scenes, like, well, what about my guy? What's going on here with my guy? Why isn't he getting...
probably parents and wives and girlfriends and stuff, right?
Yeah, there's got to be a really fine line.
Especially with these guys that are 21 years old, you know?
Yep. I mean, it's got to be exhausting. I mean, their jobs have got to be. It's why you can't ever have a coach GM in basketball, why it really doesn't work, because it's two totally different jobs.
Yeah.
And there's so many really excruciating demands in both arenas.
And there's absolutely, in my opinion, there's absolutely no reason to believe that because you're one good at one, you'd be good at the other.
Yeah, I just think that's
what it is.
Yeah, it's two different skill sets, and it's just too much for one person. Just too much.
Yeah.
Is Popovich the coach? No, he's not the GM. So even
No. He's not the GM.
So I just don't think it's possible.
I mean, I think there's some guys in the league that probably have a lot of input.
Yeah, as they should.
Yeah, I mean, maybe Tibbs. You think maybe he does? I don't know. That might be a bad example. But Popovich might be one of the few that has some input. But maybe he doesn't want input. Maybe he just wants. I mean, you know, I just want to coach him. I just want to. Well, I don't know.
There was a really good story several years ago about Popovich and just. You know, he's a real wine connoisseur.
Yeah.
So it was a great story. I forget who wrote it for ESPN.com, just about how he organizes these team dinners.
Yeah, I remember hearing
it. It was
about
a really good story, just about how, you know, you want to get everybody together and, you know, just talk away from the arena or the practice facility. So on the road, he would have his teams. And kind of the highlight of the story was that Kawhi Leonard, who was on the team then, showed up like at one of these dinners with like a bag of apples, and that's all he had to eat. And of course, you know, speaking of agents, the requisite denials were issued about that.
Which means you know it happened.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, that's... And that may... You know, think about the cultural difference between a guy like Popovich and all of his players.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Well, this leads to a tangent, and we certainly lead the podcast world in tangents.
Version,
how do you feel in this day and age, especially in your coverage of Penn State. How do you feel like dealing with guys who are literally 40 years younger? I mean, do you feel, does that distance affect how you're able to do your job in any meaningful way?
I think that you used to have a, I feel like we in general, I don't think necessarily me in particular, used to have a little more connection to them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the guys, Daryl Clark and Zach Mills, I haven't had, not that I had anything like a particularly close relationship with either of them, but the connection that you had just bullshitting with those guys, I can't imagine that with any of their players in recent years, even. And I think part of it is that they're coached a little bit more than they used to be.
I was going to mention that. Yeah.
I think that's that's a little bit of a Franklin thing, for better or worse. And from our point of view, it's worse. But they're coached more. I mean, Drew Aller seems like a really nice kid. I'm sure he's a really smart kid. Mm-hmm. He talks and talks and talks and talks and talks. So he's cooperating, but he says nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. He never says anything. I just wish that we could get a little bit more of a sense of what they're about as people.
I agree with that. And I think part of it is not only that they're coached to do it that way now, I think they're coached to do that coming up too. There's more layers of apparatus to say, well, this is what you say, this is what you don't say.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's things like that.
I mean, Drew Aller's been working with a really highly regarded quarterback's coach since he was 13 years old.
Right.
His dad was a football coach.
Right.
He's been going to these camps and this Elite 11 thing. Well, that's part of what they give you at that Elite 11 camp.
Is that right?
Yeah. How to handle everything about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think from James Franklin's point of view, Drew Aller is perfect in that way, in that thing that we're talking about.
Right.
But from our point of view, I think it might be interesting for Drew Aller to engage honestly a little more.
Yeah, it's definitely a thing. It's definitely become a thing, and it gets back to what we talked about before with the whole branding thing. Like, this is the brand you present to the public. This is the public face you present.
Yeah.
And
now, how much are these NIL people playing a role in it? How much are they going to play in a role in the future of our access to those guys?
Interesting.
That might be a thing that really makes me depressed. maybe not. I don't know. But that seems like the direction that it's headed.
Yeah, but there's definitely a wall is too strong a word, but distance that's been established, and how they're not going to play the media games is the wrong way to put it, but just they're not going to answer questions and. You know, in an in-depth way, I think it a lot. Like, I always think about, this is one just for athlete X. You say, well, tell me a story about so-and-so. And the answer is always immediate, well, there's so many. And then they give you nothing.
Nothing's coming.
Nothing's coming. Because they...
And sometimes that's probably an honest response. I can't really think of anything off the top of my head that really would be a story that would be
they're self-editing and saying, well, I can't tell that one.
That too. Yeah, sometimes it's that. Yeah.
So that always interests me. And you know, I think about just how it's evolved with the Sixers are my touchstone with that just about over the years. Like Julius Erving, he was eminently approachable. Now, he wasn't always a great interview, but he was eminently approachable.
Yeah.
And as time went on, you know, the barriers built up with like the Iversons of the world. You can get him in a group situation, but you know, you're not often, unless you're, you know, a national guy coming in, you're not going to get him in a one-on-one situation. And it, to some degree, it's that way with Embiid, although there are some exceptions to that too. So who's the writer for ESPN? I'm blanking on the name right now, but she did a really good piece.
Ramona Shelburne.
That's it. Yeah. She did a really good piece about him a couple of years ago where she was actually like driving with him between road games on the West Coast or something like that. So, you know, but that gets back to something we've always known about just, you know, your access is going to open up if you're of a certain caliber in it.
Well, maybe not caliber.
Caliber's the wrong word.
But your outlet. And
Brand.
But even that, I don't think they care about that nearly as much as they used to.
That's probably true.
You know, this guy's from Sports Illustrated.
That doesn't mean anything anymore. That's for sure. Yeah.
That is for sure. Yeah.
So But anyway, that'll serve as our segue to Penn State is sort of at an odd juncture. They played a kind of uneven, is putting it kindly.
Boy, is that putting it kindly.
Against Indiana, they give up a 90-yard touchdown pass. A 69-yard touchdown pass?
67, I think it was.
So their secondary, in particular their defense in general, is supposed to be a strength, and it really kind of let them down. But also their offense was very spotty against Indiana, a team they were favored to beat by 31, and they ended up beating them by 9. So now they got to go to Maryland this week. Maryland is really, speaking of teams that are struggling, but nonetheless, I mean, it seems like it's a really tricky spot in the schedule, which we've seen before from them.
Franklin said after the Ohio State game, he said, we've got to make sure that this doesn't beat us twice. I think that happened. If they'd have been playing most of the teams in the Big Ten on Saturday, it would have happened to them twice.
Yep.
And the same thing has happened to Maryland. Maryland has let Ohio State beat them 3 times, kind of, yeah. Arguably. They lost to Northwestern. And we got to say, this guy, this interim coach for Northwestern,
must be doing a great job.
God love him. And I was talking to Dave about this the other night. How did they pick him to be the off the staff after Fitzgerald's out at the door? How did they pick him? Because he was not a Fitzgerald guy. Was that the administration's thinking?
I don't remember.
And we had the same. Dave and I had the same reaction. I don't know, but I mean, this dude was an FCS assistant a year ago. And now he's, I mean, if I was them, I'd hire him.
Yeah.
Now.
He's certainly raised his profile. But I mean, it gets back to, this is the card that a lot of athletes and a lot of teams play on every week. Nobody thought we could win. Yeah. Only the X number of people in that room thought. But in this case, it was absolutely true.
Yeah.
So it's like a self-made motivation.
Yeah, that's true. And, I think they only had 3 wins the previous 2 seasons combined.
Yeah.
And they're 4-4 right now, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
So
Dave Braun is the guy's name, by the way.
Yeah, David Braun, and he was, I think, North Dakota State. He was a coordinator at North Dakota State.
You are correct, sir.
Yeah, last year.
He was the D coordinator.
He's a defensive guy. And Fitzgerald hired him to be Northwestern's defensive coordinator. And then the hazing stuff really blew up. Fitzgerald's out the door, and they make this guy the interim head coach. So
it's pretty impressive. Here's his resume: Winona State, Culver Stockton, Winona State again, UC Davis, Northern Iowa, North Dakota State, and now Northwestern. I mean, he's making himself a lot of money.
I would think so, because at the very least, he'll be able to go somewhere good as a defensive coordinator and make $1 million a year.
I would think.
If I was Northwestern, I would go beyond that. I'd make him the head guy.
Yeah, I think they have to, don't they?
I mean,
you got to reward this, because this is circumstances. You didn't figure they were going to win a game.
Yeah, it's almost like Bill O'Brien.
Yeah,
in a way, it's a different, but similar in the how daunting the task seemed to be.
Yeah. So I don't know what to make of Maryland, because they've just completely hit the skids. They were leading at halftime at Ohio State, lost that game, and then have lost their next 2.
Yeah, they competed against Ohio State. Now, Penn State last year, Penn State destroyed them on the line of scrimmage.
Oh, my God.
Their defense against Maryland's offense, that was a blowout. So the quarterback, Tagliavola, or however you pronounce that, he just was running for his life the whole game. He was completely ineffective. Anybody would have been ineffective, because he had no time, he had no protection, he just was. Mm-hmm. And then at a certain point in the second half, I think it seemed like he kind of quit.
Wow.
But I mean, it was 30-0, but it wasn't anywhere near that close.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that mismatch, I think, still exists in Penn State's favor.
Too.
Because their defensive line is, if anything, a little better than it was last year. And you know, somebody asked Franklin on Tuesday during his weekly press conference about kind of like you gave up these 2, your secondary's been so good, you gave up these 2 huge touchdowns.
Mm-hmm.
Did Indiana figure something out or see a crack in the armor or something? Which I don't think is true. And Franklin said, well, you know what? I mean, the 90-yarder, you know, the guy made a great throw, the guy made a great catch, then he made a great run after the catch. I mean, once in a while, if you play man as much as we play man,
It's going to happen.
Well, the other team's on scholarship, too. I thought that was fair. And then the other one was a brutally missed assignment. Mm-hmm. It was a called blitz, and it was a linebacker and a corner were supposed to read, and if this happens, one of you go, and if this happens, the other going to go, and they both went.
Oops.
That's what that was. And he just, to the quarterback's credit, he instantly recognized it, and it was the easiest pitching. There was nobody there. I'm not sure why there wasn't a safety there. Mm-hmm. that's a fair question. A Frank Broyles.
That's exactly where I was going.
And otherwise, their safeties were, I thought, a bright spot on Saturday. Their mm-hmm. safeties are playing pretty well. So anyway, I thought this was a horrible performance by the Nits. And then we didn't really get to the way the press conference played out. We didn't really get to ask him, like, okay, James, yeah, it's true that a win is a win is a win, and any win is good, blah, blah, blah. It's not easy to win. But what do you really think of this performance? I mean, I thought this was their worst game since the 9 overtime game.
Wow.
I thought it was, without question, their worst performance since then. I mean, if they play Rutgers on Saturday, they probably lose that game.
And that would be...
I mean, maybe not. Maybe Rutgers maybe not hit the big passes. It'll be interesting to see how they respond on Saturday. They are on the road. Maryland will kind of be up against the wall, too, you know. And of course, Michigan next week. So it's... I got no idea what's going to happen, but I think this has been a really interesting Penn State season. There's been a ton to write about, a ton to think about.
Right.
That's all you can hope for, is it? Yeah, I've been enjoying this season, but I don't have much insight into what's going to happen on Saturday.
Yeah, it's. I guess the number is now in James Franklin's 10 years as coach, 5 times they're. First loss has been immediately followed by their second loss, and that was a near miss.
And I think there has been like three or four other times when the following week happened.
Yeah.
Which I didn't realize that.
Is that coaching? Is that just an organization? You know, the inevitable letdown of, you know, losing a big game that you just, it's hard to summon that again. I mean, I don't know, but it is interesting.
2 years in a row. They lost by 1 point to Ohio State and then lost the next week to Michigan State teams that were clearly inferior to them, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And Franklin came out after those games and did these big, in the press conference, did these big like statements of repurpose. We're going to get in the submarine and we're going to block everything out. And if you thought I was a psychopath before, you guys have no idea.
That's the quote.
Those. And then later he said, that was a mistake doing that. I should not have come out immediately afterwards and made these crazy proclamations. Mm-hmm. That was too much. Mm-hmm. Calm down. Let's be a little more clinical about it. I guess since then there have been no, you know, proclamations like that, but it doesn't seem like the problem has gotten solved.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that really annoys me about him, after a big loss, he'll always say, I get it. Well, do you? Because the same thing keeps happening every year. I mean, to me, their seasons, many of their seasons have followed a familiar script. It's like, lose to Ohio State after like a 5-0 or 6-0 start, finish the regular season like 10-2, go to an okay bowl, win the bowl, and promise that the next year is going to be better. Yeah. And it never is.
Yeah. And I really fell for that this year because it wasn't a pretty good bowl. It was the Rose Bowl last year. And it was a top 15 at least team that they beat pretty handily in the Rose Bowl, Utah.
Right.
And I thought with what they had coming back and all the pieces they had in place and what everybody thought Drew Aller was going to be, it hasn't happened, but, you know, I guess it still could.
How would you assess Aller today? He threw his first career interception last week at a big moment in the fourth quarter. I mean, how would you assess him today?
There were some people who thought that was almost a good thing to get that out of the way.
Interesting. That's an interesting spin.
I don't know if I buy that. He did immediately. I mean, his next throw, not his next throw, but his second next throw was the touchdown pass that won it. Mm. And he finally, they
made an explosive play in the passing game down the field. So it was almost like a hallelujah mm-hmm. moment there. I think he has a ways to go as a decision maker and understanding that this guy may not be wide open, but he's open enough, and throw him and use this incredible arm talent, which there's no question he has. Mm-hmm. If you just watch him warm it up before the game, man, that guy's got a gun. He can really throw a football, and he's capable of being very accurate, mm-hmm. and he can make every throw that you ask a quarterback to make. But I think there's times when he either doesn't see it or doesn't trust it over the middle of the field, yeah. in particular. Part of it is the wide receivers, no question, but he's got a ways to go as a decision maker and as an understanding.
So I would think, just for this experience, he'll certainly be better next year. I mean, yeah. we've seen it again and again with Penn State quarterbacks. Year two is always better than year one, almost always.
Yeah, and you kind of what you just said a minute ago, Gordy. It'll be interesting to see. If they go 10-2, if they win out except for Michigan, and then they get a nice bowl, and I mean, how tired are people going to be of that? I mean, is there even going to be the enthusiasm? Because this team started this season with tremendous fan base, excitement, mm-hmm. enthusiasm. I mean, you're putting 105,000 in that place to see Delaware play. whoa. And it might not have been exactly 105,000.
Nonetheless.
But it was 100,000.
Yeah. And that's a lot of people making a long drive, paying a lot of money for hotel rooms and whatever else to watch that.
Yeah. It's crazy. So, and I think some of that is, I think the air is going out of the balloon a little bit already. Mm-hmm. But, if they win the next 2 weeks, it changes everything.
Right. If they were to beat Michigan, that would certainly be the best win on Franklin's resume, I would think.
Yeah, yeah. The Big Ten championship game
right.
would be one that you could argue about. But this one, in terms of the national picture, I mean, they're right back in it if they win that game. And Michigan, Michigan hasn't played anybody. Mm-hmm. And they're stealing all the signals too. Don't forget that.
all of them.
So, did you see this thing with Central Michigan?
I did not.
This guy, this ex-Marine who was sort of running Michigan's like filming operation.
I've heard of this.
Well, Michigan State earlier this year in September, Michigan State is playing Central Michigan. Mm-hmm. And there's this guy on the sidelines for Central Michigan in Central Michigan gear, a Central Michigan hat. He's got sunglasses on, and it's a night game. Mm-hmm. And they think it's him.
Oh, my God.
They think it's him. And this is not just Twitter nonsense. The athletic director at Central Michigan said, we're investigating this.
Oh,
and the Michigan State... I mean, doesn't anybody on the staff at Central Michigan look around and say, who's this
guy?
What is this? He's in a disguise?
And not a good one.
And not a good one, yeah. And, oh, God, it's just, I don't know.
I had not heard that. That is fascinating to me.
That's crazy. And there's video of it. There's video of it. I mean, they showed it on ESPN this morning of this guy. Pretending to be a Central Michigan staffer.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious.
Yeah,
so. Oh my god. Speaking of college rivalries, is it true that Franklin took a shot at Pat Narduzzi, his favorite foil, the other day?
It was a very subtle one, mm-hmm. and I didn't even think of it until somebody else suggested this, but after Pitt lost to Notre Dame like 56-7.
Right.
After the game, Narduzzi made some comments that are like, it's all on me, but it's not really maybe all on me. Like a little bit, it could be interpreted mm-hmm. as a little bit of a shot at the mm-hmm. players. I don't remember exactly what he said. And then some of the players like took to social media and kind of like, just like tweeting something with a question mark. Like, what?
Oh,
what?
Boy.
So Franklin said, on Tuesday, Franklin said, I have to walk a fine line because I want to answer you guys' questions, but I don't want to, get into a thing where I'm telling you guys something that I haven't already told the players, right. or that I that I'm being critical of the players, and we all know, we've all seen some examples where coaches have done that and it hasn't worked out. So I mean, these guys really dislike. It's kind
they
of
do.
Funny.
They really
dislike each other.
They really
they screw
do.
Each other in the poll,
yeah.
in the coaches' poll.
All the time.
And it's just, and they take all kinds of shots at each other.
Always. But it sounds like Narduzzi might be on thin ice, does it not?
He might, because they're really bad. And I think he's had a decent run there. Given what Pitt is right now, and given what the ACC is, I mean, I think he's had a decent run. But this year, it's just fallen. I mean, when you have a starting quarterback, and you demote him, and then immediately turn him into a tight end. What?
Who does that?
Yeah, that's so.
But I what he said about this thing about when coaches say this is all on me. I mean, it's so disingenuous. Andy Reid did it this past week after the Chiefs lost in Denver. They lost 24-9, and they've really had an odd year, the Chiefs. So, and I never believe it, and I've heard it too many times. It's just one of those crutches that coaches use.
It's almost obligatory, but on the other hand, what do you want them to say?
I know that's
the problem with it. You know, I think, honestly, I wanted Franklin to say on Saturday night, this performance is unacceptable.
Yeah, what's wrong with saying that?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, I think you could arguably, well, you're insulting Indiana.
But I mean,
this performance is unacceptable. I don't think really insults Indiana.
I don't think it does. I mean, you know, because you recruited, you have these great recruiting classes. Yeah. You have high expectations of them, and as does everyone else. I think that's within the bounds.
And Saban would have said that. Saban would have said something like
right.
that if they played this bad.
Yes. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying something like that, because I think it's absolutely truthful. And you know, you're going to ream your players out in film study and practice the following, you know you are. So you're not saying that.
And it's not the worst thing in the world for them to hear that.
I know. And it's like we've seen guys 100 million times coach their teams through the media.
Yeah.
And to me, that's a mild thing to say, but it's truthful.
Yeah.
First of all, it's truthful,
which
I think when they say, this is all on me, that's not the least bit truthful.
Yeah. And I would say this a little bit. We should have asked tougher questions on Saturday night, and this is sort of the mechanics of doing our job, but he doesn't show up for the Franklin doesn't show up in the media room for a half an hour after the game.
Holy shit.
I mean, like, after, I'm talking a half an hour after ring the bell and sing the alma mater. So I stay upstairs and work, and increasingly a lot of guys do that. I get some work done before. So then when you do that, then you're in the back of the room and they can't see you, and you're raising your hand, and they,
that's,
you know,
hard.
So I really felt like we could have been a little tougher on him in terms of just, James, you can't be telling people this is an acceptable performance. I was stunned by how bad they played on Sunday.
I was stunned. I really didn't watch it live. I was just following it on my phone, and you know, when it became 24-all, I'm like, what? Because you figure at that point, once they go ahead, what were they ahead? 24-10 or something like that? And Indiana scored, came back and made it 24-all? I figure when they went out, I figure, okay, well, it's over now.
Well, I think, if I'm remembering the sequence of it right, it was 24-21.
Yeah.
When Aller threw the interception.
Right.
And Indiana runs the ball up the middle three times in a row.
What are they thinking?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, at that point, don't you have to go for the jugular if you're Indiana? I mean, it's
and
like,
our boy Dave went to Tom Allen's press conference and asked him about it, and he said that their coordinator made those calls, and we talked about the approach, and that's the approach he wanted to take, and I signed off on it. And at that point, you just want to get some points, and you just want to tie the game.
No.
You want to tie the game on the road and give them the ball back with plenty of time? What?
That makes no sense to me.
Yeah.
At all.
unbelievable.
a tangent to our earlier point about to coaches and what they say after subpar performances. My favorite guy ever about this, a guy who wasn't a head coach, is Jim Johnson.
Oh, okay.
He was the Eagles' late defensive coordinator. When he would come in, like on Wednesdays he would come in, and we would ask him about some guy, you know, pick a player, Lito Shepard, whomever.
Right.
And he'd say, oh, he's got to do better. He knows that. And I always kind of loved that he was that frank, because if he's saying that to us, you can only imagine what he's saying to Lito Shepard in
that
film room.
That is an extremely watered down version of what Lito's...
Lito's hearing in the film room or practice.
The legendary one in this regard is John McKay being asked what he thought of his team's execution and saying, I'm in favor of it.
I love Jim Johnson had the ultimate job security because he was coaching under Andy Reid. So Andy Reid ran the offense. He ran the defense, and he gave him autonomy to do what he wanted to do. And anytime somebody came and said, we want to hire this guy as a head coach, they would rip up his contract and give him a new one because Andy knew his blind spots.
And he was great.
He was really good.
He was great at it.
Yeah, and he would just seem, he was a real decent human being. Mm. But that just cracked me. He's got to do better. He knows that. So that could, I'd love to be a fly on the wall when Lito is hearing the unfiltered version of how he covered. How he covered whomever.
Really. So anyway, that's where we are.
We'll be curious to see. I mean, I love that stadium that Maryland has built down there. I mean, it's kind of comparable to the one that Rutgers has built. Not a huge stadium, but a very nice one.
Yeah. And it really is the old. It's the old stadium, just refurbished many times. But it's really on. I like it too because it's really on campus.
Yep.
It's a little bit of a pain in the ass to get in there because you're going to these little on-campus roads. But I like it too. The only thing where it's woefully inadequate is like the visitors' locker room and where Franklin goes for the post game stuff. It's this tiny little room, nowhere near the size of our vast studio. and then the players, they have to pull the players outside. And,
oh, that's lovely.
Is it raining? I mean, that's the only thing where just.
I remember how it looks. Yes,
in terms of the logistics, it's not that part of it I don't like, but. Everything else about that stadium and that setting, pretty cool.
It's always kind of a crapshoot when it comes to the media facilities on the road for Penn State, as I recall. What did you say that one time at Northwestern? It was like basically Joe in some closet somewhere or something like that.
Hilarious. They had some tent set up like against the bleachers.
Oh dear.
And that's where they put Joe. And Joe had a cold. This is when Joe was in his was 80 years old. He's got a cold, and the people are pouring down out of the bleachers, like right on top of us, like 4 feet away from us. And our buddy Neil Gahagan sat right in front of Joe and virtually put his tape recorder in Joe's mouth. And we still couldn't hear him. We all listened to the tape, but what the hell is he saying? I don't know what he's saying. The great thing about that game, that was a crazy Penn State win. That was that 2005 year where they turned everything around and went to the Orange
Bowl. They converted that
Michael
Robinson.
Yeah, they threw it to Isaac Smolko.
Soviet dissident Isaac Smolko, yes.
Who Michael Robinson hilariously said after the game, has the best hands on the team. No, he doesn't. No, he did not. But he made a play. And I got Michael Robinson and his mom.
Nice.
And there was some, they were like quoting Frederick Douglass. And it was really good. It ended up being a pretty good story, even though you got nothing from Joe, except...
I kind of love that.
It's like what a way to make a. That was one of those what a way to make a living moments, you know.
I remember you telling that story about how Neil had his tape recorder basically in Joe's mouth,
right in front of him, like right here.
So Neil was the de facto pool reporter.
Neil was the pool reporter. You know, in a room where we were 4 feet away from the subject.
So the only thing you got from Joe was, you got an F.
You guys get an F. You guys get an F. Joe, we got nothing. We can't hear you.
Yes, that's his point exactly.
But it was it wasn't obviously not all on Joe because this downpour, people pouring out of the stadium.
Yes.
It was just a roar in your ears.
The media logistics on the road often leave something to be desired.
Yeah, yeah. I remember Indiana at one point was putting you in this like utility shed where there was a tractor there. And they put Joe up on a little platform. And, get it. But it's gotten better. Actually, almost everybody has better facilities than Penn State does now. Everybody in the Big Ten.
Which leads to my question, where do they stand as far as stadium renovations at Penn State? Where's that stand?
For some reason, they had, under Sandy Barber as the athletic director, they had this big strategic plan for facilities and upgrades.
But the football stadium was like last on the list, right?
Why? Yeah. I don't know. But right. They're starting to, they just this week started doing like, what if we do the fan surveys? What if we do this? What if we do that for season ticket holders? What if we do this? What if we, what do you think of this? Blah, blah, blah. So it seems like it's a little bit more urgent now, but I don't think they're close. I don't think they're close to having anything. I think they're going to end up with a little bit smaller stadium capacity, right around 100,000. They want to have that 100,000. That's sort of like a point of pride or whatever, I guess.
I guess that.
Michigan and Ohio State have that too, but also like maybe like more club seating, more fan amenities, kind of thing. That's the direction that they're headed, but I don't know when they're going to get there.
So there's two things that I would love to see. I would love to see more of a facade along on the sides, so you cover all those girders and things.
It doesn't look like a big Erector set. Yes. It looks unfinished.
And also, we need a press box like the one they showed in that one movie.
The Paterno movie where Al Pacino in the title role. Yeah. Where it was like a sports bar. I had to laugh when I saw that.
I remember you saying, I never saw that, but it just sounds like the distance between that and reality is the Grand Canyon.
It is vast, my friend. Vast. So anyway, we're looking forward to a better press box. But I may not, my career may not last to see it.
Yeah,
well. Because I'm closer to the end than the beginning. That's all I'm saying.
Well, there you go. Yeah. But anyway, that's another story for another time, I'm thinking.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think we've reached the end of our journey for this week, though.
Yeah, well, yeah, we had fun, didn't we? Without a guest.
Yeah, I thought it was great.
A lot of yakking.
We went down a lot of different avenues, tangents, as we are wont to do.
And we'll be back next week with more. And, everything is going on right now.
Yeah.
This is prime sports time where there's like this traffic jam. So we'll have guests and we'll have fun stuff to talk about going forward. Am I right,
Beacon? I think we will. I really look forward to it, actually, if things fall into place for us. So, depending on current events and such. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's where we're at. So we'll talk again.
All right. He's Gordy and I'm Mike. See ya.
See ya.